You are listening to The Bell Post.
Welcome to Season 2 of The Bell Post. In Season 1, our first episode was with a group of bondsmen talking about what the heck do bondsmen even do. And so for our second season, we wanted to start again with one of those simple episodes talking about why is the private surety bail system so effective in what it does. To have this discussion, we need to begin with a common understanding of the different types of release mechanisms that are used for pretrial release across the United States. The private surety bail system is one type of release. In Texas, it is the only type of release which is protected by the Texas Constitution, which means the other types of release can be taken away by either the legislature or by an executive order by the governor. But release by sufficient surety cannot be limited by the legislature or the governor without a constitutional amendment to the Texas Constitution. The second type of release that I would mention is the release by filing a cash bond. A cash bond can either be in the full amount of the bond, which is what the requirement is in Texas, or it can be a percentage of the amount of the bail set by the court. So the point that I would make is that a cash bond can refer to multiple situations, and you really need more information to know what they're referring to. In Texas, a cash bond means that they're posting the full amount of the bail set by the court by filing cash. Texas does not authorize the filing of a percentage bond. The next release mechanism that I would mention is the use of a personal bond. That can mean a personal bond, like in Texas, a PR bond, a personal recognizance bond. You're being released on your own recognizance, or like in New York, for certain charges, you're released with no bail. All of these things means the same thing. You're being released upon your promise to return to court. And it is just based upon your promise and really not anything else. And finally, the last release mechanism that I'll mention isn't really a release mechanism at all. It's really just preventative detention. It's going back to the time, to the law as it existed before, like the Magna Carta, where charges could be filed by the king against the duke, and he could hold the duke until the court decided that his case was going to go to trial. And if the court or if the king decided that his case was never going to go to trial, then the duke could be held forever until his death. And so the Magna Carta was the first document where the sovereign's right to hold somebody awaiting trial was changed, so that the sovereign agreed that under certain circumstances the person held would be released. And so if we're expanding preventative detention, we have to first amend the Constitution, and we're giving the state the ability to hold somebody until their case gets to trial. Most of the time it's because of the severity of the crime and because we consider the person dangerous. For example, capital murder. But even for these very severe or substantial charges, the Texas Constitution puts heavy restrictions on the court's ability to hold them without a bond. So as we're talking about reforms, about potential changes to the criminal justice system, these are the four types of release mechanisms that are used across the United States. They may be called different things, but generally, the release mechanism that's being used will fall into one of these four categories. Now, before we go on to talk about different reform proposals that have been made or used or implemented in different parts of the country, let's start out with talking about how bail is supposed to work. And then later we'll talk about how, if we want to streamline the process, there are things that can be done there. And we can talk about the different reforms that have been attempted. So someone is arrested. They're brought before a magistrate. Bail is set and a bond is posted, assuring the court that they will return to answer the charges. There have been several groups that have argued that there should not be a requirement for setting a bond because there's this presumption of innocence. And I would just mention that while that makes great rhetoric, in the factors that are set out for in Chapter 17.15, the Texas Code of Criminal Procedure, not which is the factors the court must consider in setting bail, not one of those is the presumption of innocence. The presumption of innocence applies at trial. You are presumed innocent until a jury of your peers finds you guilty. And the requirement of bail doesn't have anything to do with the presumption of innocence. The requirement of bail is the assurance that you're giving the court that you will show up to respond to the charges that have been filed against you. So a defendant contacts, or the defendant's family contacts, a private surety bondsman, and they post a bond for the defendant. They fill out their paperwork. They agree to certain conditions, and those can be as simple as reporting once a week to the surety company so that they can stay in contact with them. A lot of times these defendants are nomads. They haven't found their place in society yet, and so it's hard to find them once they start moving around. And so if the case takes a significant length of time to resolve, they can be difficult to locate. As the charges get more substantial, the surety may require additional reporting or other conditions on their agreement to post this bond. Depending on the charges filed, the surety may require the involvement of certain family members as additional assurance that the defendant will appear for court. As the case goes forward, if the family members notify the surety that the defendant is getting back in trouble, is using drugs again, or is doing things that he or she should not be doing, the surety has the ability in Texas to report that conduct to the court, and the court has the ability to issue a warrant. I've seen examples where judges got upset with the surety for not reporting such conduct to the court when it took place, and I've also seen instances where the courts were upset with the bondsman for reporting that conduct to the when it took place. Additionally, if the defendant gets arrested on a new charge, the surety has the ability to notify the sheriff where the defendant is located so that the court will know where he is and how to get him when his charge or when his case comes up for resolution. As the defendant is reporting to the surety, the surety is communicating about court dates. The defendant may notify the surety, hey, I got a court date today. Or the surety may notify the defendant, your case has set for a hearing. One of the important tasks that the surety does is to provide the defendant with notification of upcoming court dates. How important are these reminders? Well, one of the things that I think that gets lost in the debate about reforming the criminal justice system is that the majority of the bonds that are posted in the state of Texas has this special language called you will appear instanter. Instanter means essentially, you know, it's a Latin term, but what the term means is really you're standing outside the courthouse door at waiting to be called in at any time. I had a bondsman call me one time and say, you know, the judge did not notify me of this court date, or the court did not notify me of this court date, so they can't forfeit this bond. And he was mad because the judge said, I don't have to give you the court dates. And I had to tell him the bad news that his bond said instanter, and so the court didn't have any requirement to give him notice of court dates because it was the defendant's responsibility to find out his court dates on his own because that's what the bond said. Now, you would hope that this would not be the normal situation, that the normal situation is we're all working together as a team. The court gives the bondsman notice of the court date. The bondsman gives notice to the defendant, and the defendant appears for court. So let's continue through the process. The bond's posted. The defendant is reporting to the surety. He's appearing for his court dates. And at the end of the process, either he is found guilty, he pleads guilty, or he's found innocent, or the case is dismissed. Once that happens, he's completed the process and his bond is discharged. The problem we have, though, is when during the process of the hearings that are set by the court, the defendant fails to appear for one of those hearings. Once there is a failure to appear, the different types of release mechanisms that are being used will cause the case to go down different roads. If the private surety bail system is used, then the The bondsman knows that he has a limited window where the bondsman has to get the defendant to return. If the defendant returns within that very limited window, then his case can be put back on track, and the defendant surety is rewarded by paying less than 100% of the bond, depending on how long it took. The surety is rewarded for returning the defendant quickly so that the criminal case can get back on track. If a cash bond is used, or if a personal bond or a PR bond, or if the defendant's released without bond or their own recognizance, then if they fail to appear in that situation, then a warrant's issued, and the warrant is going to go down to the warrant division at the sheriff's office and join all the other warrants waiting to be served. In our large urban area, these are tens of thousands of warrants, and that means that we're really going to have to wait for either the defendant to come back willingly, or we're going to have to wait for the defendant to commit another crime to be brought back into the criminal justice system. How significant is this difference? I think it's very significant. I was at an interim hearing years ago, and the director of the pretrial services department in Bexar County testified on a panel with me, and he admitted that when they had multiple PR bonds that were posted on an individual, they always required one of them to be a surety bond. And the reason why they did that is because if the defendant failed to appear for court, then the PR department could call the surety bondsman and say, "Go find him. You posted a surety bond." So in that situation, the surety bondsman could do what the PR bond department could not, and that is go out and find the defendant and get them returned to custody. So we've talked about how bail is supposed to work, and we've talked about a little bit about the different release mechanisms that have been used or are being used across the country. So let's talk about the proposed reforms that we've seen across the country, and let's see if we can classify some of them and talk about them in groups. First, I would say that one of the assumptions about bail reform is that, you know, a defendant does not need a bondsman, that by and large, people will go to court without a bond. And I think that's been proven to be false. I think during the pandemic, we found that people will not go to court if they're just released en masse. Also, reforms that we've seen in California and in New York have also highlighted that defendants who are just released on their own recognizance do not see this as, oh, thank you for the generosity and I will come to court. They see it instead as a green light to commit more crime, and they almost kind of get to the point where they're goading the police. You know, the first type of reform that we saw kind of pushed in Texas was when Senator Whitmire filed a bill probably 6 or 8 years ago seeking to bring the New Jersey plan and apply it to Texas. The central feature of the New Jersey plan is that we're going to have a risk assessment. We're going to have an algorithm that's going to tell the courts whether the defendant was dangerous or not dangerous. And so the court could decide, hey, you're not dangerous, I'm just going to release you, or you are dangerous and I'm going to retain you in custody. There end up being a lot of problems with the New Jersey plan. In fact, we've even done a whole episode of what the New Jersey plan entails. If you have not listened to that episode, I would invite you to listen to our episode number 18. The New Jersey plan had three key components. Number one, we're going to relieve jail overcrowding because we're going to force the police to use cite and release for a vast majority of crimes, and so they just can't arrest people. So that'll relieve your jail overcrowding. Next, they created a statewide pretrial services department to oversee the defendants that they do release pretrial. This ended up being a very expensive component. They ended up having to have a statewide tax increase just to fund it. They've run out of money several times. And then the third component of the New Jersey plan was this perception that they were extending the use of preventative detention. But the reality is they turned the concept on its head, and you had to have a mini trial within 72 hours of arrest, where the trial court did not have any discretion. It was just making a determination of whether the DA established by clear and convincing evidence certain essential elements, and if they were not met, then the defendant had to be released. This caused a lot of problems with DAs not wanting to disclose their evidence within 3 days of arrest, and so they're forced to decide, do we put on our evidence now, or do we allow the defendant to be released? Now, the New Jersey plan is considered to be a failure at this point in time. There have not really been many other states or jurisdictions that have proposed the adoption of the New Jersey plan, basically because of the cost. So the next big push for bail reform probably came from California with Proposition 47. And the proposition seemed reasonable when it was proposed. The proposal was that we were going to change certain felony offenses to misdemeanor offenses. The argument was they would still have to respond to the misdemeanor charges. But then after it passed, we had DAs in certain urban jurisdictions who decided in California that they were no longer going to prosecute certain of these misdemeanor offenses, which included theft under $950. Now, if the public had been asked, do you want to decriminalize theft under $950, the public, I think, would have overwhelmingly said, no, we do not want to do that. But that's not the way it was presented. It was presented that we're going to change certain felony offenses to misdemeanors. That got the support of a lot of politicians across the spectrum of the political parties. Right on Crime supported that. TPPF supported that. And I guess my criticism of that support was how short-sighted it was. It should have been anticipated that this is what was going to happen. This was the natural consequences of decriminalizing certain crimes from felonies to misdemeanors. Since Proposition 47 has passed, you can see the negative consequences increasing over time. Crime has increased. You have shoplifting that has just taken off. You have stores that are closing because they can't withstand $25,000 a day in shoplifting. And now you're getting to the point where businesses are closing because they don't believe that they can provide a safe working environment in those locations for their employees. And so they're closing down shop. The next big push for reforms came from Texas in Harris County, where a federal lawsuit was filed against the misdemeanor courts alleging that the use of a misdemeanor bail schedule violated procedural due process. Harris County case is the first example of several that have happened since that time of an attempt to weaponize a federal court to force changes in the law that the legislature would have never approved. We were told in Texas that we had to change our bail system because it was unconstitutional. We kept being told over and over that private surety bail system was going to be held unconstitutional, so we had to find an alternative, even if that alternative was substantially worse than the current system. The problem is the bail system was not held unconstitutional. We've had two appellate courts now rule that the private surety bail system in the United States is constitutional. The Harris County case would make a great model for study. The trial court ruled multiple times that the system being used by Harris County was incorrect or improper, and the Court of Appeals kept reversing Judge Lee Rosenthal, saying that she went too far, and ruling at one point that the existing judges had a substantial likelihood of success and even stayed Judge Rosenthal's ruling. But because of the political climate, new judges were elected. They were elected upon the promise to settle the litigation and give the plaintiffs whatever they wanted. And so essentially, the litigation was settled based upon Judge Rosenthal's trial court rulings, or implementing the trial court rulings, and ignoring the Court of Appeals rulings. And then in their settlement, they added certain elements of just craziness. Example, the settlement tied the hands of the judges, and they could not do anything to a defendant until they failed to appear for court three times. And then, as failure to appear rate skyrocketed, the courts decided to quit requiring defendants to show up for court. And so, as you can imagine, you're not ever required to appear for court. And then if they finally do make you appear, you just don't go. They can't even do anything to you. And as a result, case backlogs continued to increase. The numbers of cases that were dismissed skyrocketed. I can't tell you how many examples there are over and over where a defendant is arrested, they're released, they're appointed an attorney, they fail to show up for court, the court doesn't do anything to them because they've entered into a settlement agreement where they can't do anything to them, they don't return, and so the court, instead of taking any punitive action against the defendant, they just dismiss their case. According to HarrisCountyCourtWatch.com, the current failure to appear rate on average for the misdemeanor courts in Harris County is 80%, and in August 2022, a list of the dispositions for that month showed that over 90% of the cases disposed in misdemeanor court for that month were just dismissals. And so it just looks like the judges have thrown up their hands. The criminal justice system has collapsed. They can't get anybody to do anything, so they're just dismissing cases. And you listen to this and you go, that can't be true. You go to HarrisCountyCourtWatch.com and you'll find out that it is. Next reforms came from New York, and they changed their laws to state that for these a list of certain crimes, you had to be released with no bail. As I pointed out earlier, that's the same thing as a personal bond, a PR bond, or you're just released without bond. Since these reforms were enacted, crime has increased. We have seen the failure to appear rate skyrocket. We've also seen at least two occasions where the legislature has rolled back the original law and tried to limit its application to fewer and fewer circumstances. These calls to repeal the are continuing. Now, when you look at these suggested reforms, you know, I think you would have to come to several conclusions. Number one is, are these really reforms or are these just pushes to decriminalize certain crimes? I mean, in California, in New York, and even in Harris County, the number of cases that are just being dismissed are just increasing substantially. You have to wonder if that was not the original purpose of the reforms, and it wasn't really about reform. It was about decriminalization of certain crimes. Because over time, we've pointed out that the failure to appear rate for these other release mechanisms is substantially higher, and that has a very negative impact on the criminal justice system as a whole. It slows down the criminal justice system. It makes you have to put cases on hold because a criminal case is not like other situations. If a defendant doesn't show up, you have to put their case on hold. You have to wait for them to come back. And so you can see that there's been some attempt by the reformers to address those bad consequences of the proposals that they're pushing. The Vera Institute came out and they said any reform would result in a 40% failure to appear rate, and they thought that that should be acceptable. Now, I want you to think about that. You've got a current system that has a failure to appear rate of less than 10%. So for every 1,000 people who are required to come to court during a week, you've got about 100 people or less who are not showing up. So these courts that are already short-staffed and don't have a lot of time to spend on an individual case are now being told that now you're going to go from 100 people or less failing to appear every week to over 400 people failing to appear, and that you have to put their cases on hold, and that's just going to increase as it starts to snowball down the hill, that should be just okay. That should be acceptable. For those of us in the criminal justice system, we recognize that is a system that will create chaos, more and more chaos. Chaos prevents the courts from functioning. Chaos puts pressure on the courts to dismiss more cases. Chaos prevents the court from giving justice to victims. And so we start to wonder, is that not one of the goals of these reforms, to create more and more chaos? Now, I know some of you are thinking, well, that's not what these reforms are attempting to do, Ken. You are just showing your bias. But I'm going to ask you to stick with me for just a moment. Let's go back to the New Jersey plan, and let's talk about one of the components of the proposal, and that was that we implement a statewide risk assessment that will tell the court whether a defendant is a risk to the public safety or whether he can be released. A risk assessment completely ignores one or more of the key functions of the private surety bail system. It ignores the fact that the private system provides substantial monitoring of defendants while they're out on bond. I've pointed out that the private surety system provides the highest level of supervision that no one else can provide. And you know that from the New Jersey plan. It's cost prohibited. The statewide pretrial services department that was implemented in New Jersey was very costly, very expensive, and required at least one statewide tax increase just for funding. And at the end of the day, the system that was replaced in New Jersey was worse than the system that existed before the reforms. Additionally, the use of a risk assessment just also ignores the fact that the private surety system provides notice for hearings and ensures that defendants are aware of their court date and remind them to go to their court date. We hear all the time that, oh, we can replace that. We can just do a statewide text messaging system. The problem with that is we're dealing with nomads. We're dealing with people who don't fit into society a lot of times when we're talking about career criminals, when we're talking about gang members, or when we're talking about drug addicts. And if you're going to give somebody, oh, we'll just give them a free phone and we're going to provide them text reminders, well, if they're going to sell their phone so that they can go buy drugs, and or they're going to get rid of their phone because they don't want anybody to know where they are. And that's a repeated problem that we see in the bail industry. And we have a long track record of keeping up with defendants and getting them to go to court. This argument that we can just be replaced with a risk assessment score ignores all that and says that that's irrelevant. And I think that's one of the key things that the bail industry does. I've argued many times that the private surety bail system is the grease that keeps the wheels of the criminal justice system turning. A risk assessment score cannot do that. It cannot remind court reminders. It cannot provide supervision. It just tells you whether they're going to be a risk to the community at that time. And then we haven't even talked about all the different studies that have come out calling into question the efficacy of using the risk assessment in criminal justice. Finally, the last type of reform that I want to talk about is the reform that was implemented by the Texas legislature in SB 6 in the last legislative session. I think the most important aspect of SB 6 was the requirement that judges or courts review criminal histories before setting bail. I think to the public, it just makes common sense that you should look at somebody's criminal history before you're setting their bond. And I think also the public doesn't realize the technology needed to be able to implement such a system. SB 6 implemented that technology, and we're still experiencing some growing pains, and I expect that to be tweaked in the next legislative session. The next part of SB 6 that I would point out is the limitation of the use of personal bonds for certain violent offenses. This part of SB 6 built upon some things that happened during the pandemic. The governor issued Executive Order 13 limiting the use of PR bonds during the pandemic for certain violent offenses. That was appealed to the Fifth Circuit and to the Texas Supreme Court and was upheld by both of them. Specifically, the Fifth Circuit held that a PR bond was not something that was protected by the Texas Constitution. Essentially, the court ruled it wasn't a surety bond, and since it was not protected by the Constitution, what the legislature gives, the legislature can take away, and during the pandemic, the governor could take it away. So going forward, what can we expect? Are we going to have a continuation of the debate that we've had for the last 3 or 4 years, where we're going to have pushes from one advocacy group to begin or continue using more and more alternative release mechanisms that make the system worse? Are we going to continue to see more and more advocacy for reform, which is really nothing more than advocacy for decriminalization of crime? So how do we improve the criminal justice system? How do we make it better without breaking it? In our urban areas, I would just point out we have this juggernaut, and it's called magistration. If you're arresting on average 1,000 people a week for misdemeanor crimes, then each one of them is going to have to go to a magistrate. Anything that we can do to divert people away from magistration and then get before the court, that will speed up magistration. There are two ways to do that. The first is the use of a bail schedule. Nobody really wants to talk about a bail schedule anymore, but it is something that's been upheld by the courts. It is a way to get people to divert away from magistration if they can afford to set a bond. That allows the trial court to use its limited time and resources and its discretion on the people who are left, so that they can make a determination of the proper release mechanism to be used for those individuals. Under SB 6, we've seen this proliferation of this debate about whether a bond amount set with a warrant is mandatory or permissive, or it should be ignored. And we've seen testimony by the Office of Court Administration pointing out that the public safety report, it's not always easy to determine whether a bond amount was set pre-indictment or post-indictment. And the current analysis is that if it's set post-indictment, it's mandatory, but if it's pre-indictment, then it's just a suggestion and can be redone by the magistrate. I think this issue was all created because of the requirement of the public safety report at magistration, and I think that can be eliminated if we just backed up the requirement of a public safety report to the issuance of a warrant. I'm not certain law enforcement would be agreeable to do that at this time because we have these problems with double entry of data, once in the local system and then in the OCA system to get the public safety report. They're talking about creating certain interfaces so that the OCI system can interface with each of the different local systems, and I think there's like 6 or 7 of them that are being used. Once that is done, I think that the ability to just push a button and generate a public safety report will proliferate, and we can use those at the issuance of a warrant stage. Once we do that, then any warrant that has a bond amount tied to it should be mandatory, and that would actually speed up the process of getting people arrested and processed. The question I started today with is, why is the private surety bail industry so effective? I think the answer to that question is the bail industry has been around for several hundred years, and it does one thing, and it does it very well. It gets people to go to court. Private surety bail industry has the lowest failure to appear rate of any release mechanism currently used other than preventative detention, where you just don't release them. If you take a step back and look at the reforms that are being proposed in different parts of the country, these reforms are really a push for decriminalization of crime and a push to use other release mechanisms that are recognized to have a far inferior or a substantially worse result, which would create further and further chaos to the system. Even the Vera Institute recognizes that. So I kind of wonder why We started this debate with, we have to find an alternative to bail, private surety bail, because the current system is going to be held unconstitutional. When that argument's made, you can understand why we have to say, okay, we have to find an alternative, even if the alternative is not as good. But now that we've had multiple courts hold the private surety bail system constitutional and that it is permissible, then you have to go, well, why are we pushing for reforms that make the system substantially worse than the current system? Or let's state it another way. Shouldn't we, through reform, be looking to make the system better, not worse? We've had other pushes in our history to try to reform the private surety bail system. And I think at the end of each of those cycles, I think the conclusion was ultimately made that we didn't have anything that we could do to make the system better over what it was using at that time. And I believe strongly that that is where we are now. We've had multiple years to push for reform to take us to systems that would be worse than the current system. Initially, the arguments were because we had no choice, the current system was unconstitutional, that's all been rejected, that's all been changed. So we need to find reforms that are going to make us safer, that are going to make the criminal justice system work, that's going to be able to provide relief for victims. And that is not to use a release mechanism that has a substantially worse track record over the private surety bail system. So why is the private surety bail system so effective in what it does? It does one thing. It does it very well. It gets people to go to court. If you care whether people go to court, you want the private surety system to be used more often, and you want an alternative release mechanism to be used on a limited basis for only those who cannot. You want somebody looking over the shoulder of the people that are released. You want somebody reminding them to go to court. You want somebody reporting to the court that when someone is starting to use drugs again, when somebody is off track. You want somebody reporting to the court when they're rearrested on a new charge or they're in jail somewhere. The private surety system provides this at no cost to the taxpayers. As we have found with the New Jersey plan, any attempt by the state to replicate that would be hugely expensive and would not operate near as well. I hope you found this topic informative, and thank you for coming to our first episode of Season 2.
Thank you for listening, and come back for the next episode of The Bell Post.